Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 106, recorded June 5th, 2013. Howard Reingold. Triangulation is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 26 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps take you and your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code TRIANGULATION6. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get great minds and get a chance to sit down and spend some time talking about great ideas. It's one of the shows I look forward to each week. Each week, our producer, Kashtan Bondi, comes up with somebody interesting. The reason we call it Triangulation, well, originally it was because Tom Merritt was sitting in the other chair. But now it's you sitting in the other chair. If you watch us live when we do the show around 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time on Wednesdays, let's see, that's 2300 UTC. You can ask questions in the chat room, and I think you might want to ask questions of our next guest. He's great. Howard Reingold has been around for a long time as a commentator, a critic, a writer, a teacher about internet culture. He has the best painted shoes in the world, and he is just a fun person to talk to. His most recent book called NetSmart, How to Thrive Online, but you may remember Smart Mobs, which he wrote. He is just a great guy to talk to, and we're so glad to have Howard Reingold from his perfect office in Marin County joining us. Hi, Howard.
Hi, from my dream office to your dream studio.
Exactly. Although I might want to be in your dream office instead. Are you wearing painted shoes, hand-painted shoes today?
I am not. I am barefoot. But oh, I will give you an exclusive here.
Okay.
This is my latest pair in progress.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.
I've not gone this direction before. It seems like every summer I feel like painting my shoes.
But it's better if you don't have to wear them. That's even better yet. So, but you don't want to paint your feet. That's no good. How do you describe, when somebody says, Howard, what do you do? How do you describe yourself? Because it's hard to nail it down.
You know, that's exactly right. And I started out to be a writer and did my sentence in a room alone for a long time with a typewriter. But as the technology has come along, both for creating stuff and for communicating with people about that, I thought, why limit myself to thinking of myself as a writer? So I try to explore and understand what's going on, particularly about the intersection of technology and minds and communities, and to facilitate discussion about and understanding of what it is that I find when I'm exploring. That's maybe a longer explanation. So in the process, I do write books and articles, but also instigate online communities, teach courses, make videos. We've got a lot of tools at hand now that we didn't have when we both started out.
Yeah. It's changed a lot. I didn't realize, I was just looking at your Wikipedia article, and I remember this, Out of the Inner Circle, A Hacker's Guide to Computer Security in 1985, when I think many people didn't even know there was such a thing as computer security or hackers. And then you worked as the editor-in-chief of the Millennium Whole Earth Catalog at the Hotwired, which was a great, one of the first, in fact, commercial content websites. In the mid-90s, Wired Magazine did that. And Electric Minds, I remember. Was Electric Minds a spinoff of The Well?
Well, my experience with The Well and with Hotwired led me to think that where things were going with the birth of the web was towards a social web.
Yeah.
And that wasn't at all clear back then, in 1995. So Boy, that was a great education for me. I certainly learned a lot about how capitalism works in Silicon Valley. And I think a lot of intellectuals have a kind of unearned contempt for commerce. But, if you meet a payroll, or better yet, fail to meet a payroll, you understand how things work a lot more than just reading articles about it. Anyway, I had a combination of social media, though it wasn't called that then, and user-generated content, although they didn't call it that then. No. 10 years too early.
Right.
And the death of our business model was that this was in the age when you had humans selling ads for you. It was 4 years before Google was even born. And that made a huge difference. So in 1990, I think we were named one of the 10 best websites by Time magazine in 1996, and we were out of business by July of 1997.
Oh no, we're just on that Time magazine list this year. I'm worried. Now, but a lot of this started at The Well, and so many of the people we've talked to on this show were regulars on The Well. There was something, including myself, there was something magical that happened. The Well was a creation, I guess, of Stuart Brand as an extension of the Whole Earth catalog. It was the Whole Earth Electronic Link. And for me, it was my first experience of a social community, exactly. Didn't have a name for it. First experience on the internet, even, because I used to drop out of the Well shell down onto the command line and go for a round. Why was the Well so important? Why does many things still come out of that?
If you talk to Craig Newmark or Steve Case, they'll tell you that they were inspired by the Well.
Yeah.
I think the reason it was successful and the reason it's had such influence is that it was really the first social network of social networks. So there were lots of networks before the internet. The whole point about the internet was to connect them into an internet work. And I think that's what Stuart Brand brought to it, was that he brought the Whole Earth people, who were themselves a diverse lot. They weren't all granola hippies, by the way. When I was editor of the Whole Earth Review, I met generals. I met people from the intelligence community. It was a lot of interesting people involved in that network whose common thought was think for yourself and let's use tools to be self-reliant. Brought that community together with the emerging personal computer community, the Xerox PARC people and the Wozniaks, and did that in the San Francisco Bay Area. And one genius thing that Stuart did was that he had a $0 publicity budget, but he gave free accounts to journalists. Mm. And so, John Markoff was there, Stephen Levy was there, a lot of people who are still technology journalists found that to be, as you and I did, an early watering hole for people who thought something is brewing here.
Yeah,
we had no idea that I would be in my office with this little thing called a laptop and communicating and broadband video with you.
That's pretty amazing how far we've come. And yet, I look at something like Reddit at Web3062 in our chat room points this out. Reddit is in many ways a well for our time.
Well, I'm glad that those general purpose emporiums still exist, because since then the world has been filled with all of these very specific niche publics that you can communicate through any number of media, whether it's Tumblr or Twitter or Facebook. You can zero in on the people who are interested in exactly the same subject as you are. The place where lots of different people come together to talk about lots of different things. Before the Well, there were the bulletin board systems.
Right.
That, I would hate to see that lost. And I'm afraid that Facebook groups have sort of educated the world in a bad way about what forum-type communication ought to be like.
What's wrong with Facebook?
Well, Facebook. There are many lively Facebook groups that people are having rich conversations in, but you have to go look and find that thread that you posted in, or someone has to post in it, and you have to be notified about it. gee, back in the days of the well, 1985, you simply said, show me the next new post and the next thread
that I follow. You could do that, yeah.
It's very, very, I mean, so the problem was solved a long time ago. They must not want people to have persistent conversations that way. And also, it's very badly indexed. So anybody can start a thread, great. But then if you come in a year later and you're interested in a particular subtopic and you want to find that conversation thread, maybe it hasn't been posted to in a week or two, so it's not visible. How do you do that? All of these problems were solved before, but and Google Plus doesn't get this much better with their communities.
Part of it is the vastness of these communities, isn't it? I mean, the nice thing about the well was you could read everything.
Yeah, well, at one time you could read the entire Usenet. And remember when the web first started, the Mosaic browser, the NCSA, every morning they had a list of cool websites. These were the cool websites that people created last night.
Cool site of the night, yeah. Cool site of the month, yeah. Boy, you can't do that anymore.
No, but the way I think about it is that you're talking about Twitter or Facebook or Reddit. These are pools of potentially interesting people that if you know how to tune in, right, you can add to your personal learning network. And I don't think that any of the real communities, sub-communities, very active networks, however you want to define it, we could delve into that if you want. I don't think that they're much larger than the Dunbar number of around 150. All of these big groups, like the Well, had conferences, mm-hmm, and there are usually a couple of hundred people in each conference, and there's always a commons. One thing that I learned from the Well is if you're going to create an online community that has specialized niches for different interest groups to crystallize around, also create a commons that everybody's got to go hang out in, the kind of main street where the people who are talking about being a parent and the people who are arguing about sports and the people who are media people can all mix with each other. And I think that's really still an important aspect of social life online.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of what's changed is just the quantity of stuff. You know, YouTube has, 100 hours of video uploaded every minute now. And, Google Groups, Google Plus, you couldn't possibly follow every thread. It all just kind of scrolls by. Twitter's even worse.
Well, I think the hyperabundance of knowledge is both a real problem, a problem in the sense that not all that knowledge is good knowledge. We have a hyperabundance of information, much of which is bad, and will kill you if you follow the instructions. Now, really for the first time since people started recording and transmitting knowledge with writing, the key question is, do you know how to ask the question? You know, if you can formulate the right magical spell, the right search query, you can get the answer to any question.
Yes.
And you can do it anywhere, pretty much on Earth, within a second. To me, that's still amazing. Of course, the trick is it's now up to you to determine whether that information is good information, bad information, misinformation, disinformation. The need for critical filtering, which used to be fulfilled by the editor, the publisher, the librarian, all of the gatekeepers who are gone now, that needs to be taken up by the consumer of the information, the citizens, the participants. If you learn the basic literacy of how to ask questions and how to determine whether the answers are accurate, you have access to knowledge that no human being, no emperor in history ever had before. You know, it's everything from quantum theory to the nearest pizza joint to how do I use a jigsaw. I'm still astonished by it. But
it blows me away too. But it seems like we've lost the forest for the trees.
But that's where my
here comes the plug. NetSmart. So how does one thrive online? You say forming the right question is a start.
Well, the reason I wrote the book was, I've been writing about where are personal tech computers or social communication online or mobile devices. Where is this all taking us for a long time now, for 25, 30 years? And I have been asked the question by critics and reviewers, and I have asked myself the question, is this stuff any good for us? Do the pluses outweigh the minuses, and what are the minuses anyway? And I've become convinced in my old age, being a university professor at this point, that the answer is it depends on what people know. That the quality of information and determining the quality of that information online is so important. It's important politically to our democracy. It's important to your health. Who doesn't Google their symptoms? It's important to every aspect of our lives, but the technology and all of this information has come along much more rapidly than our educational institutions have changed. So there's a new literacy, a number of new literacies that are absolutely vital. It's not rocket science. It's not as hard as learning to read and write in the first place. And some people know it. A lot of people know it. It just hasn't really been taught to people. So I went out and I did what a writer does. I did my research, and I talked to Jimmy Wales and Dana Boyd and Kevin Kelly and people who ought to know about different aspects of this. But I also consulted my own many years of experience online. I tried to come up with what I would give my daughter if she was graduating from high school today and heading for college and heading into the online world. What would I give her to be able to not only survive but thrive there?
This is good because my son's graduating on Friday, so let me know what should I tell him.
Okay, good graduation present.
Yeah, well, he's a digital native, right? He grew up with this.
Yeah. Okay, so you know what? I've been teaching digital natives for about 10 years, and absolutely, hand them a piece of technology. They will not read the manual. They will click on stuff. They will talk to their friends. They will figure out how it works. They can text with one hand behind their back. They all Facebook.
That's right.
That does not mean they understand how to use RSS to bring information to them, or really how to do a sophisticated search, or necessarily know a lot about a critical examination of the information that they found. How do they blog as a filter blogger for a particular public? How do they blog to advocate something or use a wiki to organize? Right. They're not necessarily adept at all of these different new rhetorics. I mean, after all, it only takes 3 or 4 or 5 years to learn to basically read and write. Why do we continue to educate people in the language? It's because you need to know how to make a sentence and create a composition and persuade people or criticize intelligently what other people have written. I think that there's a lot to be learned, whether you are a digital native or you're an old guy like me that makes common sense. And it's not just about searching and finding. It's about participating and collaborating and understanding how networks work. And I start with attention. It may seem a little bit different from the other literacies I'm talking about, but our attention is really challenged. Everyone knows by the screens that we've got. They're attention magnets. You know, the Pew Internet and American Life study found that 1 in 6 Americans have admitted bumping into something or someone.
That's a low number.
Texting while looking at their smartphone screen.
Who hasn't?
And you know, you're online on your laptop or your desktop at work, and there are so many cute cat videos. There's a lot that demands your attention.
Yeah.
How do we deal with this? Well, and there have been books written about how we're all becoming incredibly distracted, and it's destroying human sociality. And I fundamentally disagree that it is the technology. The technology certainly is an attractive nuisance. It affords distraction. It doesn't compel it. We can learn to control our attention. And controlling your attention online, I think, is the difference between success and failure professionally and personally, and really on the level of all of our individual efforts adding up to a really valuable public good and not a complete cesspool full of really ill-informed posts and blog threads and spam and porn spam and all the other bad information out there. You know, we can't really regulate what people put online, nor should we. But I think we can educate people about filtering the good stuff for each other, just as you are doing now and I do.
Yeah, certainly what we do here. You know, if you watch all the time, everything all of our staff is doing is trying to make some sense of all this. Nick Carr calls it the shallows. He says it's ruining how we think. It's ruining our brains. You disagree, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, you know, in that same book, he talked about how he had to go to a cabin in the Rockies where there was no bandwidth and no electricity to get away from things.
Yeah.
And any writer can tell you that the world is full of distraction in a completely empty room.
It's called Windows Solitaire.
You can take a pencil and doodle with
yes.
it. It's about your attention. You know, I would agree with him that a lot of people are thinking in a very fragmented manner. But
yeah.
I would say two things. I would say you're kind of stumbling around and you don't really know what you're doing. But aren't you participating in the creation of culture in a radically different way than when you were a couch potato and your only choice was which channel created
mm-hmm.
by someone else
mm-hmm.
to watch? So I'd say that any participation at all gives a sense of agency and autonomy to people that's vitally important, not just for digital culture, but for democracy. But I would also say that if you learn how knowledge is being constructed these days and understand the networked nature of knowledge and social communication around it, you have the ability to think in ways that people never were able to think before. And in fact, that's why Doug Engelbart created all of this in the first place,
right.
to augment human intellect. That the technology can do that does not guarantee that people are going to know how to do that. That's why I wrote the book. I'm certainly not the only one. I quote a lot of other people.
Joseph Campbell said, if you don't like the culture, create one of your own. And we've never had more capability of doing that than right now.
Well, you know, I think people tend to forget that the internet itself was created by a culture of people who foresaw that the technology that they just happened upon because of the Defense Department and the state of technology in the 1960s and 1970s, that this would enable people to build things together that they were never able to build before. And they didn't know what people would build, so they didn't constrain it. The community of people who are sharing, not because we are communists, but because every time we make our self-interested intelligence public, it comes back to us tenfold.
Absolutely.
That culture is, I think, maybe in peril.
Do you think so, really? It seems it's more dominant than ever before. You look at open source and Tumblrs. I mean, people are putting this stuff out. They're giving it away.
I'm so happy with Tumblr, and I'm happy to see that the Obama administration is getting on the case
they
of
have a White House
patent
Tumblr.
Trolls. But there are a number of forces. Patent trolls were one of them. The extension of copyright laws where
yep.
the Obama administration's on the wrong side,
mm-hmm.
and net neutrality. There are Facebook trying to make the internet into Facebook. Our reliance on Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple. I think that there are things to, I wouldn't say worry about, but I wouldn't be complacent about the fact
yeah.
that open web has
yeah.
existed and will continue to exist. You know, there used to be this saying, and I confess to being one of the people who passed it along, that the internet interprets censorship as damage and roots around it. And now, you know, companies can sell routers to China and Iran that will automatically filter
yeah.
out discussion of certain things. So I am not a paranoid, but I think that you have to be naive to not think that there are very powerful forces that would like to make you be an employee of a content firm
right.
to create the next Google or Facebook in your dorm room.
Yeah. Well, it's worth so much, it's worth defending. I mean, however great you feel the threat is, if there's any threat at all, we need to protect it.
Well, I think it's worth defending. We can defend it by creating. And so knowing there are so many ways to participate. You can make
it. Don't be a consumer, be a creator.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have enough consumers.
Well, I don't think anyone would voluntarily describe themselves as a consumer. We don't think of that as who we are, but we do consume. And I think
everybody does. We have to at the same time.
And it's an enormous power.
Right.
What we choose to consume and what we choose to share that we consume, that's important metadata about what's worth paying attention to.
But don't just be a consumer.
No. Participate.
Participate.
Blog. Yeah. Edit Wikipedia. Yeah. Comment on YouTube. There are so many different ways to do it. Pinterest.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so easy now, actually. You have this Rheingold U, which I think is great. People can find it at your website, rheingold.com/university. And the current course is Intro to Mind Amplifiers. Infotension, curation, augmentation, cooperation. What are mind amplifiers?
Well, you know, I first discovered personal computers because I heard that people were able to use these machines to retype pages by just moving things around on the screen. And I was tired of having to retype a page after I'd written on it so much that I couldn't read it anymore. And I swiftly discovered through the writing and then the meeting with Doug Engelbart that these were designed to be much more than better typewriters. They were designed to be ways for people to think in ways that we weren't able to think before, to collaborate and communicate in ways we weren't able to collaborate and communicate before. And I thought, oh my God, it's a mind amplifier. Yeah. I'm a writer. I'm not tied to the typewriter. Why should I be tied to the library book?
Right.
And the telephone, which were my research means at that time. So I embraced not only the medium as a way of enabling me to do more and better than I had done before, but as something new in the world, the way writing and the alphabet and the printing press were new in the world. And that was the way that the people who were creating these technologies at Xerox PARC in the 1970s and then, you know, later at Apple, they knew that what they were building on had been created to amplify the ability of the mind. So I never cease to be fascinated by that. So I teach this course to introduce people both to the ideas and to the how do you do it. We were talking about curation a minute ago. So
yeah.
We have some great curators. We've got Robert Scoble and Robin Good and Maria Popova out there who are creating a whole art form by finding stuff and showing it to us. It's not only the superstars. It's all the million niche curators that have their niche publics who are saying, I spent 3 hours a day looking for good stuff about topic X, and here's what I think are the two or three things you ought to pay attention to if you're interested in topic X. That's increasing the collective intelligence of the web. If you want to get started on collective intelligence, start curating, start paying attention to other curators, start paying attention to the people who are following you. So that's an example of a skill. Infotension is talking about trying to train your attention skills in regard to information online. And we also talk about personal learning networks, how we can find people we can learn from and learn with and follow them and engage them. And the last session is organized by the learners. The meta learning at Rheingold U is really about co-learning. So you have to register for the course and pay me, and I definitely do some lecturing. But for the most part, it's really about my facilitating what people naturally do but have been unable to do since schools have had the monopoly on education, which is to learn together. To be human is to learn together. So I'm very excited about co-learning. We use live sessions with audio and video and whiteboards and slides. and asynchronous media like forums, blogs, and wikis, and I make it clear to people that they are not just there to absorb what I have to throw at them. They are there to help us co-create knowledge. And I think that this is what's happening. You want to learn how to do something? There is a 14-year-old who's made a YouTube video.
That's true.
How to do it. I think that we live in a world in which just the know-how about how to go about learning things is the key to this just treasury of knowledge that we can access together. We can teach each other. So this Rheingold U is a natural outgrowth of my experimentation. It started when I started teaching college students at Berkeley and at Stanford about social media issues. Only makes sense to use social media if you're going to teach about social media. And one of the things that social media does is it kind of flattens the hierarchy. It's no longer just the teacher standing up talking at everyone else who's taking notes. It's us having a conversation with each other. And what that led me to do was to give more and more of my teacher power and responsibility to the students. They became co-teachers. My students form co-teaching teams with me. It seemed to me that the next step after that was to really have a co-learning environment in which the learners play an even greater role. And out beyond Rheingold U is Pedagogy. If you go to Pedagogy, Pedagogy.org, that's a volunteer effort that I organized with about 30 other people to create a handbook for self-learners. There is no teacher. You figure out how to crowdsource the teaching among you.
It's interesting because the early days of the university, that's kind of what the universities were. They were collegiums. There were people. You didn't have a professor. You might have a facilitator, but really it was scholars gathering together to talk.
Yeah.
And in an era where facts become kind of free and widely available, teaching is no longer about imparting facts to people. We can give that up now.
Well, I don't think we can give it up. You want your surgeon to know the nerves of the face.
Yeah, okay, you're right. yeah, you're right.
However, I'd say an enormous percentage of the facts that can be presented in the 4 years a student is in a residential college, the world is going to be full of very different and very important facts
right
when they emerge. And when I first started teaching, I latched onto a book called Teaching is a Subversive Activity by Neil Postman and Charlie Weingarten, and in which they said, if you're in a civilization and a society that have existed in many places in which life doesn't really change a great deal from year to year, generation to generation, it's the duty of the older generation to pass along what works so that the younger folks don't have to reinvent the wheel. They know the accumulated right. cultural knowledge of their group. If you're in a society or civilization that changes very, very rapidly, it's the duty of the older generation to teach the younger generation how to learn. Mm-hmm. How to figure it out for yourself. Mm-hmm. What does this new thing mean to me and others? And how do I evaluate it and decide whether I'm going to pay attention to it or not, or adopt it and use it with others? Those are decisions that you have to make from an experience in being an agent of learning, of experimenting with things and sometimes failing, and not just being the kind of the passive sponge of learning who collects all the facts that are taught to you. There's a certain amount of fact collection still has to happen. But there's something new in the world, which is if you don't learn how to use technology to continue learning, you're going to have a much more difficult time of it. And so will our entire culture.
We're talking to Howard Rheingold. Howard's most recent book is called Net Smart, How to Thrive Online. And it's kind of what we're talking about right now, is how to thrive online. It's on Amazon, both in a Dead Tree edition and in a Kindle edition as well, which is nice. You can download it right now and start reading it as soon as Howard's done. We're going to take a little break. We'll tap more with Howard in just a bit. But I want to remind you, our show is brought to you today by our friends at Shutterstock.com, a great place for stock photos, illustrations, vector graphics, video clips. In fact, they've now got 26 million of the above for you to choose from. And at a very affordable price. But Shutterstock is more than just a place to go to buy images. I think one of the great things about Shutterstock is it can be an inspirational tool as well. You can create a Shutterstock account without buying anything. They're absolutely free. And once you do, you can search for images, ideas by color, by emotion, by gender, as well as by keyword. You can also use their light boxes to save and share images and ideas. So I think for a blogger or somebody who does writing, sometimes just having an image can trigger a whole bunch of writing. It can give you so many great ideas. Here's hippos. Why is it you always search for hippos? Is it because of Cranky Hippo? Yeah. Yeah. Cranky Hippo's Brian Barnett, one of our TDs. We call him that. You can, by the way, okay, so you got hippos, but you can narrow it down. You can have female hippos, male hippos, cranky hippos, happy hippos. You can have purple hippos because there's a spectrum tool that lets you choose a color. So if you've got a palette that you need to match in your web design or your brochure, you can do that too. They sell individual image packs or a monthly subscription. That's the best deal. In fact, I have the 20. There they are, purple hippos. $25. I'm sorry, 25 images a day with my standard subscription. They have a great iPad app. Talk about inspiration. You can search on the go. Look at images, use them immediately if you want it. Won a Webby Award. It's just gorgeous. Also a global company. So I know we have viewers all over the world. Shutterstock is in Germany, China, Italy, Brazil, Belgium, and on and on and on. Truly a global marketplace with customer service and dedicated reps in each of those countries speaking all so many languages. You will love Shutterstock. I want you to try it today. Just sign up. That's kind of neat. What were you searching for that light bulb?
Science.
I like that. That light bulb could be Howard's next shoe design. I like that. In fact, I think I saw Howard wear a shoe that looked like that. Shutterstock.com. 30% off your new account when you use our offer code Triangulation6. That's a good deal. 30% off. But you've got to use Triangulation6 so that they know you heard it about it right here on Triangulation. Shutterstock.com. Howard Rheingold is our guest. He's a professor, a writer, a lecturer, a critic. A commentator on the world, the new world we live in, and has been somebody who's been along for the ride the whole way. How did you seek out Doug Engelbart?
I did. Well, you know, it started when I was looking for a word processor, and they didn't really exist then. In fact, I went to Apple, which was two buildings at that point, and this is in the early 1980s, and I found Jeff Raskin.
Oh, Jeff is amazing.
He was amazing.
Amazing guy.
An amazing guy. Late Jeff Raskin. And he had written a text editor for the Apple II. And he said, unfortunately, it's not going to be useful for you as a writer because the founders, the visionary founders of Apple, were pretty sure that people were going to use PCs for gaming and programming in BASIC. And so there's no real need for uppercase and lowercase. And so the hardware only supported uppercase letters. So that didn't work. And so then I found out about Xerox PARC. And I called them, in fact, every week, asking them if they had any work for a freelance writer until finally I found some work there. And that led me to Bob Taylor, who was in charge of the computer systems laboratory that really produced the first personal computer, the one that Steve Jobs saw and emulated. And he introduced me to Doug Engelbart, who at that point in the early 1980s was still trying to make his vision work. And he's still with us, by the way. He must be close to 90.
Ancient, yeah.
Yeah, but Doug's story really enthralled me because he started thinking about this not because he had been an entrepreneur or an engineer. There are not that many computers around, but because he thought that what he knew about computers manipulating information and what he knew as an X-radar operator in the Pacific during World War II was that you could paint information on a screen, that if you put these two things together, that maybe people would be able to solve problems together. And he saw that that was the big problem in the post-war world. So he came up with this whole notion of augmenting human intellect. They invented the mouse. That's what most people remember about them. But also hypertext, video on computer screens, outliners. I'm sure I'm leaving out a whole a whole lot.
Well, the GUI.
The GUI really. So point and click and command the computer instead of giving it an arcane command line set of keyboard strokes. That was a big step in enabling people's minds and computers' processing to begin to work together. So I thought that it was that Apple and Microsoft were definitely interesting, but more interesting was this larger vision that that had led to the creation of these devices. And there's been a thread ever since. In fact, Fred Turner at Stanford wrote a book called From Counterculture to Cyberculture that really tied the whole Earth network to the development of what became the personal computer and the web. And I think it's certainly true that the commercial exploitation of this technology created the world that we're in now. But I'm sure you remember a time when people said, I'm going to make money on the internet. We're laughed at.
Yeah.
This was all created by amateurs who wanted a better tool.
Yeah. Well, we interviewed Doug on the Screensavers. He brought his prototype mouse.
Yeah.
He was old even then. He's 88 now. I just looked it up on Wikipedia.
But, you know,
an impressive fella.
Tim Berners-Lee, David Karp with Tumblr, they're in that tradition. They were people who had a vision of open participation. And I'd say that Mark Zuckerberg's version of everybody sharing would be connected with that, except the open part.
Yeah.
You can't try to own the whole thing.
It's almost as if he took these ideas and he didn't quite get it. And I worry that that's a generational thing, that those of us who watch this struggle happen maybe have a better sense of how important it is that it be open, that this creative ferment happen, that that innovation be allowed to succeed, and that there's a generation that came later that took it for granted a little bit and didn't really understand how important it was to kind of nurture it.
Well, you know, I would say one counterexample, tragic counterexample, is the late Aaron Schwartz.
Yeah.
There was a young man who was just so devoted to open. And I think there are many others. And, you know, Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs sold blue boxes before
they were hackers.
Sold computers.
You bet.
There are some 14-year-old hackers out there doing naughty things online today who are going to get tired of doing naughty things and are going to create the web or the Tumblr of tomorrow.
Yep. Well, and I think that hacker spirit is what prompts you to create. It's the idea that I'm not going to accept the limitations that this thing gives me. I want to try to see what else I can do with it, things that never were imagined. That's hacking. You know what is encouraging, and I wonder how you feel about this, is this whole maker movement, this kind of, it's almost like for our generation, the back to the earth movement. It's the back to the physicality movement. Let's make actual things.
Here's my Arduino.
All right. I love it.
I got sucked into that because I wanted to make my art light up. And it turns out you can order the LEDs, and there's this little $35 thing you can buy that you can program, and suddenly I'm drawn into programming and trying to figure out how to do it. I discover there's a whole community of folks who are making Arduino stuff. There's the Raspberry Pi. I've got one of those on the other end of the room. There's a whole community around them, and both of these are involved in education. You know, one of the things I do is I write a blog and do video interviews for a site called DML Central, and I just interviewed a science teacher in a high school in Los Angeles who's using Raspberry Pi, which is a little $35 computer, general purpose computer that has about the same processing power as an iPhone 5 does. And this high school teacher in LA is using it with students to do citizen science.
Lovely.
They're not only are they doing this themselves, but they're doing something that counts in ways that never were possible before. So I think the whole maker, there's a lot of attention on the 3D printing, that this is going to revolutionize industry, and maybe it will. But I think what's really interesting are people making things, that the communities of people were not just creating culture. They're not just creating code. They're creating things in the physical world. It's exciting. It's fun to get drawn into it. It's that same hacker spirit. It's about overcoming obstacles and creating neat things and sharing them with each other and building on each other's work.
You know, the guy just down the road here, Mark Pauline, just used LEDs to light up the Bay Bridge. I'm sure you've seen it. It's an amazing, beautiful sight. And they, sometimes it doesn't have to have a purpose. It could just be beauty. It's art.
You know, there's a huge movement of people who do things just to make an artistic impression on others. The whole Burning Man community within these people who make big things. You know, I've been to probably every major museum in the world, and you see things that people make at their own expense out there on the playa that you won't see anywhere else.
Yeah.
So now you don't have to have a welding torch and a giant truck to haul your stuff around. You can make these little things. I just, you know, I'm all for individual empowerment and participation. And I know that there's a critique of that there's an awful lot of crap out there. And that's certainly true. And it's certainly true of the printing press enabling a lot of people to write.
Yeah.
A lot of crap has been written.
Okay.
But guess what? People find the good stuff and tell each other about it. And the more people writing or the more people making, the more good stuff will emerge. I think it's, you know, almost a Darwinian process.
One of our chatters wanted me to ask you about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. This is openness with an eye, with a political bent, an eye to changing the world.
Well, I have to say, I don't know much personally about Julian Assange. Just what I see in the media, and I understand that there are a lot of forces to try to portray him in one way or the other. So I don't really know whether he's a hero or a villain.
What's the truth? It's hard to tell, isn't it?
But the WikiLeaks, that is a, whether you like it or not, that's a natural outgrowth of the world that we've all become committed to. And by we all, I mean practically everyone in the world. You know, you can shut down the chat rooms and the YouTube, but our electrical grids, the way the food we need to eat moves into a city, the way sewage moves out of a city, it's all networked. We're all connected into this thing. You know what? I lost the thread. Where was I going with that?
I don't know, but that's good. I don't. we were talking about WikiLeaks and.
Oh yeah. So accept a world in which digital media moves pretty freely from place to place and thing to thing. It's going to leak. If you've got a billion,
just like sewage.
Yes. So the world in which a few people could control secrets,
it's gone.
Because you could lock up top secret papers in a safe.
Right.
That world is gone. So whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, I think you need to recognize that, for better or worse, a lot of what used to be done in the dark is going to be done in the open. You know, we don't see a lot of images in the mass media of what really happens in a war. We see what the military selects for their embedded journalists to see for the most part. But now, we're seeing right now from the streets of Istanbul, the Turkish government would not like images of what's happening to be out there, but they're on YouTube in an instant from somebody's phone. We live in a world in which you can't make a racist remark to a one audience when you're on the political circuit and not have everybody in your state know about that. That's what happened to George Allen when he ran for the Senate. Transparency and openness are built into this world that we've accepted. And you know what? There's a dark side to it for sure. Surveillance, none of the people who had great fears about surveillance in the past from Orwell and Foucault onward could have imagined the world of sensors and big data and being able to collect every phone call, every text message, every time your cell phone moves from one cell tower to another, every time you cross a bridge with an automatic transponder, every time you swipe your credit card, you're creating this cloud of information that can be sliced and diced and aggregated. Things can be sold to you. You can be persuaded of things. The state can find you if they want to, no matter what. There were people, you and I among them, who were wondering what we were getting into 15 years ago. That was the time to think about, is this the kind of society
we want
to move into? So now that's the world we live in. What do we do with it? That's really, I always come back to, yes, it's important to have philosophical and political arguments about whether all this technology is very good for us or not. A lot of it is not so good for us. But I think that it's essential for us to think, say, okay, given what we're living with, what can we do?
Yes. I think that there is an attempt by some to roll the clock back to say, let's stop it. And you can't. So you've got to figure out how to make it work. And I guess thinking ahead 15 years, which ways we want to steer it so that 15 years hence we won't say, gee, if we'd only thought about it 15 years ago. What should we be doing now to plan for the future?
Well, you should plan for a future in which you don't want to be in a public place with someone you shouldn't be seen in a public place with.
Yeah.
because somebody there is going to be wearing their Google Glass or its equivalent, and we'll be filming it, and faces in what they video will be recognizable, and people will upload it. You know, years ago, before the kind of advanced things that we're talking about with Google Glass happened, at a conference, a young man said, I want to be a hacker for the NSA. And so I've kept myself off the internet as much as possible. But you know what? People take a picture of me at a party with their phone, and then they post it on Facebook, and they tag it with my name.
Yep.
I can't control it.
Nope.
So, you know, I think that there's some major adjustments we're going to have to make about what we consider to be our privacy. I don't think it's a really comfortable world, and if we could have prevented it from being this way, I would have done that. But I think particularly when you're teaching young people these days, you have to teach them that you are creating a profile, and you should be aware of it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I say is if you want to control, you can't stop it. So if you want to control it, create stuff, create great stuff, put it out there.
Yes.
And let that be the thing people find about you.
Yes, absolutely.
I hate to say it, but when you're, you know, 12 years old, you got to start thinking about reputation management. But
yes,
that's the way it is.
Well, you know, one of the people I consulted about that issue was Dana Boyd, who's done a great job actually going out and talking to young people about how they use media, and she points out that teenage drama has always existed.
Oh, yeah.
Teenagers and their best friends and their feuds have always existed. Bullying has always existed. Experimenting with your identity, with your peers has already always existed. But now, and young people ought to know this, everything you put on the internet will be there forever. It will be searchable and connectable to your name. It will be seen by people you don't know. It can be copied and distributed to everybody in the world in seconds. And that makes for a very different kind of teenage drama than what has always existed. You need to be aware of the way in which your digital reputation is being shaped, whether you want to or not. People are shaping it. You need to try to take some control of that process.
That's a good note to end on. The book everybody should take a look at, NetSmart, How to Thrive Online, available on Amazon. Howard Rheingold has been our guest. You can't do wrong by thinking about what's happening and what it means to you and to your children. And it's a good idea to perhaps, maybe I'll get this book for Henry. He's graduating on Friday. This is stuff he should know by now. But if he doesn't, I'm going to make sure he gets the book. Be a good graduation present. Thank you, Howard. It's great to talk to you again.
My great pleasure.
Yeah, Howard Rheingold. We do Triangulation every Wednesday. Hope you join us at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC, on twit.tv. Live is great because then I can see your questions, your thoughts and suggestions and pass them along to our guests. But we make every single edition on demand, available, audio and video, on our website, twit.tv/TRI. It's, of course, on YouTube, but it's also on everywhere that podcasts are aggregated, like iTunes and so forth. So please subscribe, get every issue. And if you've missed a few, we've got 106 total. Go back in time and read them or watch them or listen to them at twit.tv/TRI. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation.